Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Christmas holiday, which, although heavily commercialized, is ostensibly a Christian celebration of the birth of Jesus Christ, and speak with Frank Schaefer, a best-selling author whose parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and leaders of what became known as the religious right. Having worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson, Frank felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith, which led him to depart from the evangelical movement. His latest book is And God Said Billy, and we will discuss why American evangelicals and Christian fundamentalists voted overwhelmingly for a serial philanderer and owner of gambling dens who openly boasted about coveting his neighbor's wife in a video in which he boasted about his exploits as a sexual predator who could grope women with impunity. Then we will speak with Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow at Political Research Associates, who has been an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. The author of Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, he joins us to discuss the role of Vice President Mike Pence, who appears to pretty much run the Trump administration, and whether Pence, who has shown theocratic tendencies, is in fact a dominionist, who sees the Lord Jesus as the ultimate political authority and ruler, and believes that God has called upon conservative Christians to exercise dominion over society by taking control of political and cultural institutions. And joining us on this Christmas Day is Frank Schaefer, who is a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson, before he felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead him to his departure from the evangelical movement. Frank Schaefer's novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, Sex, Mom and God, and his latest, And God Said Billy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Schaefer.
Hey, thank you.
And I don't want to be sacrilegious on a religious holiday, Frank, but frankly, with all the commercialism associated with Christmas, I think the the sacrilege has already been committed at large, if you will. But on this day, what are you celebrating?
Well, you know, the family circle has to be drawn much closer than usual. You know, I'm with my 3 out of my 5 grandchildren and a couple of my kids, and look beyond the front door, as it were, into an alien universe in which there's really very little celebration. You know, if I'd been living in Germany in 1936 or so with what was on the horizon and had been a Christian, I wouldn't be exactly celebrating big Christian holidays when the white conservative Christian majority had just elected Adolf Hitler. And I'm not making a direct comparison with Trump, but in terms of my unease about the future of this country, on this Christmas Day, I think you would have to be a fool or a happy white supremacist, one or the other, to feel this was a holiday like any other. I mean, just take one sort of unrelated crazy news item. Liberty University, run by Jerry Falwell's son, who I knew when he was a child, and I spoke from Jerry Falwell's pulpit as an evangelical activist back in the 70s and 80s, is now running a university in which they encourage their students to carry loaded weapons in case those Muslims, quote-unquote, put in an appearance. And this Christmas, they celebrated it not by donating to some charity or extra money to the Salvation Army or to a homeless shelter. They just cut the ribbon a couple days before Christmas on their new $1 million firearms gun range to train their students in this quote-unquote Christian university. So, you know, if the leading and largest Christian evangelical institution in America is celebrating the birth of Christ by telling people that they're training future Christians to gun down anyone who opposes them or shows up at their college in a headscarf and threatens them, and this is the way they interpret Christ's admonition to love our neighbors and turn the other cheek, there's really very little to celebrate. So when you talk about sacrilege or taking Christ out of Christmas, or people who object to someone saying Happy Holidays instead of Merry Christmas, you got to understand the evangelical 81% of the white electorate that just devoted their energies to electing Donald Trump, led by Christian leaders such as Franklin Graham, who I also knew as a child. My father was a friend of Billy Graham. Donald Trump, hobnobbing with these people and getting the backing of Jerry Falwell Jr. and his gun-toting school, we are in a tough spot. And this goes far, Ian, you and I have known each other for a while, but this goes far past our usual political discussion. This is not left versus right or liberal versus conservative. I grew up knowing the Bush family. Ronald Reagan sent me a handwritten note of condolence when my father died. I am birthed out of the Republican right-wing conservative movement, and this is nothing to do with even that kind of conservatism. This is a new thing we have here, this hybrid of Christianity and this demagogic person who has become the president of this country. This puts us in a very difficult position if we're people of faith, and if we're not, just kind of head-scratching. So this Christmas, I just have to say it, Happy Holidays or Merry Christmas are both totally inappropriate. I think rather we are back in Bethlehem with with Mary and Joseph, who cannot find a place to have a child and wind up in a stable and then have to flee as Herod kills the innocent children to round up this unwanted alien being, this Christ child. These metaphors are so close to home now that it makes my hair on the back of my neck stand up. So the true Christian celebration of Christmas this year is trying to figure out how we're going to help the people who are going to become the victims and the enemy of the state. You know, I just got off my Facebook page right now getting a message from someone who was telling me, I'm so afraid personally as a man of color living in the South. It was tough before Donald Trump. Where do I go now? Who do I call now? And there are people out there who are not paranoid, and they are certainly not silly when they say they are personally afraid. My gay friends, black friends, people of color, various individual backgrounds and so forth, very much under threat now in this new regime. So this Christmas time, let's, from my point of view, stand up very clearly with, as it were, those mothers and others in the Christmas story who are going to be threatened by King Herod because he's looking for the Christ child and wants to murder him before he can become the king of the Jews. You know, these metaphors apply all too well today, and I am not having a hysterical fit here. You know, the true situation we're in is past politics. You know, you and I have discussed things on the air here during the Bush presidency, and we've followed each other through the years where Barack Obama has been lied about and vilified by the Republican majority in Congress. But even in those periods, we were still in a normal political situation. Now we are in an abnormal one, at least in terms of what is normal to American history. And I just think to not take stock of this is criminal. And we have to just resist and start deciding what we're going to do individually to stand up. I don't have any easy answers on that, but this is no normal Christmas.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Schaefer, who is a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. However, he felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement, and his novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, Sex, Mom and God, and his latest book is And God Said Billy. Of course, another irony, Frank, is that Christianity itself was kept alive after the death of Jesus Christ, largely by the Palestinians, by the Arabs. And eventually, 6 centuries later, it got into Europe and has become, of course, a global religion. So there's certainly no, with this new ambassador that they're talking about, Trump has appointed to Jerusalem, and moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, as they plan to do, is going to inflame that already divided part of the world from which sprung Christianity, and also in large part is also Jerusalem, of course, being the third holiest shrine in Islam. Let me just run something by you, Frank. My understanding, and I try to follow things as closely as possible, and I do have some pretty good sources. My understanding is that Trump is holed up in Trump Tower watching TV all day, and then he gets all upset with cable news if they don't say nice things about him. He tweets in the middle of the night. He doesn't really want to be president. He doesn't want the job. He doesn't want to take intelligence briefings because he's embarrassed by his own ignorance. And essentially, the country is being run by Mike Pence. And we already have the Koch brothers' cabinet installed. They've got all the legislation ready to go. The Koch brothers essentially have got their wish list beyond their wildest dreams have come true. So don't you think we should focus a little on who Mike Pence is?
Yeah, and of course, you know, Mike Pence and my family are connected in that he is a convert from Roman Catholicism to right-wing religious right Christianity of the kind that, you know, my father, Francis Schaeffer, with his books like A Christian Manifesto and Whatever Happened to the Human Race and his anti-abortion crusade with Dr. C. Everett Koop, who became Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General, you know, we were very much part of that movement which Mike Pence has joined. And so what we have in Mike Pence is an unreconstructed fundamentalist, evangelical, far-right winger who really genuflects not before the altar of Jesus this Christmas day, but before the altar of Ayn Rand, who has become the god of the right-wing Christian movement, displacing Jesus a long time ago. So when you understand that these people have been waiting, ideologically waiting, as it were, in the wings since FDR to undo the social contract and the safety net, they now have their opportunity, because Donald Trump neither has the intellectual chops or the willpower, let alone the concentration span, to resist them. And so while he's grandstanding around the country being cheered by whoever he is going to cheer him that afternoon after some grand gesture, wherever it might be, meanwhile, legislatively, unopposed, the Republican Party is going to enact everything they've always wanted to. You know, the silver lining to this cataclysm is that if we survive this, and there's a real if there, I mean, who knows with the foolish things he does, having begun his presidencies by alienating, for instance, the Chinese government for no good reason, with an off-the-cuff conversation with somebody in Taiwan, in an ill-considered moment, you know, all bets are off. But if we survive, of course, it's going to mean that we are going to see the full ugly force of right-wing legislation. The problem is that the Republicans, as they've just proved in North Carolina, are no longer committed to democracy, so that when, for instance, a governor is elected they don't like, they change their system to strip the governor of power. And they've done the same with gerrymandering all over the country in their congressional districts and redistricting. They control 39, I believe it is, of the state houses now. By the time the Trump presidency is done, the real agenda of these people is going to be to solidify their minority rule in very much like apartheid was solidified in South Africa, which I lived in for a year, where you have a white oligarchical minority ruling a diverse population, but who has jerry-rigged the system in a way that gives their diminishing numbers when it comes to population and white becoming a minority race and so forth, longevity far beyond what the actual vote, when tallied democratically, would give them. And so the real danger, I see it, aside from the end of the world, great, and some insane thing that he does in between the Palestinians and the Israelis, for instance, or in the Middle East or with the Chinese or whatever it may be, is this completion of this Republican dream of so fortifying themselves against demographic change that the districts, the congressional districts in the Republican-controlled states, are drawn in such a way to make them battle-proof and election-proof and voter-proof for, you know, decades to come. And this is their program. This is what the Kochs have been working on state by state. They put all their money into the state elections this year, by and large, having st- stepped outside of the presidential election, and now it's come their way anyway. So between the Koch brothers and Mike Pence and that kind of Paul Ryan and these other people, the legislation's written to roll back Medicare, to decimate Medicaid, to first of all throw Social Security into turmoil, and then eliminate it by quote unquote privatizing it and so forth. They're actually going to be able to do all this stuff, and if somehow they can be stopped from gerrymandering the system to the point where Democrats simply can't get elected anymore, no matter what the number of votes is in terms of the popular vote, state by state, the full weight of what a country with a decimated social safety net looks like is going to crash in on us. The sad thing is that millions of people, beginning with people thrown off Obamacare, are going to be chewed up in the process. The working class vote, white, black, any color, any religion, any voting bloc, any party, is going to be chewed up first, and after that, the rest of us. So it's grim, because the more these folks, quote-unquote, succeed, the worse off we're all going to be in the long term. And the only way they could stay in power, and they, I think, understand this, is by jerry-rigging the system so that come future elections, it becomes increasingly impossible for a Democratic majority to prevail. What the solution is, I don't know. You know, they'll be appointing judges. They'll be putting their own people on the Supreme Court. We're in for a very grim historical cycle here, where all the battles of the 30s and 40s and 50s have to be refought. You know, Nina Simone, call your office. Martin Luther King, where are you? I mean, we are in trouble. And it isn't just race relations or homophobia or these other things. It's the basic economic structure and social contract that has kept this country stable, relatively prosperous for half a century or more. That's what we're looking at in my view.
And we're going to take a brief station break here on this Christmas Day, and we'll return in a moment with a conversation with Frank Schaefer. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And on this Christmas Day, we are speaking with Frank Schaefer, who is the best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. However, Frank became increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement, and his novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, Sex, Mom, and God, and his latest book is And God Said Billy. So just before the break, Frank, you were talking about this grim picture of America under oligarchical rule. So what is going on here? I understand the agenda of the oligarchs, that they, some of them are enlightened, but most of them are just incredibly greedy. And the idea that they have been the beneficiaries, the 1% of the 1% for so long, it just makes you wonder what more they want. But they're going to get more. The Republican enablers like Mike Pence and Paul Ryan will give them massive tax breaks. And Donald Trump, of course, has a cabinet full of billionaires. I mean, George W. Bush had a few millionaires, but Trump has like 5 billionaires in his cabinet. So we're heading into this peculiar era of greed on steroids. What is their vision, the ultra-wealthy, the oligarchs that are fund, that like the Mercers who funded Trump and others? What kind of America do they want? Do they want to step over homeless people as they go into a fancy restaurant? Do they want a third world roiling underclass of people fighting over the scraps that are thrown under the table? Do they want to live in gated communities and forget the rest of America? What is their vision of our future?
You know, I think they probably fall into two categories and then points in between. One is, you know, I put it this way, Americans have this great love affair with money to the point where we think that people who have money are smart in an intellectual sense. And I actually have known some very wealthy people in my time who, when it comes to just common sense and ordinary human wisdom, are some of the stupidest people I've ever met. They have a genius for making a particular kind of money, or they inherit money and they are surrounded by people who invested it well, or they're very good on Wall Street. But that doesn't mean they can read the newspaper consistently for 30 or 40 years and draw a picture that could be called anything that you and I would call a world view, which gives them a grid through which to process information. They see the bits and pieces of what affects what they do. They are not people necessarily who are wise in the way that word has been used classically. So they can believe their own bullshit, as it were, and they believe the gospel of Ayn Rand on one side that suits their egos, and then on the other hand have absorbed what my friend Jack Kemp, who used to be a congressman and ran as vice presidential candidate with Bob Dole, he was a true believer in both this sort of trickle-down economics, but also this idea of the Laffer curve and empowerment through lower taxes and so on, that it would create an explosion of prosperity. And of course, it never did. It doesn't work. But you got to understand, their voter base are evangelicals who believe in Noah's Ark, but not in climate change. And so science and facticity has nothing to do with this party anymore. When it comes to the rich, the elites, they believe what they want to believe. When it comes to the lower middle class white voter who has put these folks in power, they are into a fact-based, a fact-rejecting view that doesn't begin with politics but begins with theology, a kind of a literalistic, fundamentalist theology that sees itself in permanent opposition and under threat from fact. You know, these are parents who homeschool their kids instead of sending them to public schools because they don't want them taught evolution, and it goes from there, or that mentality goes along with it anyway. So that, you know, there's not a point of pressure where you can say, okay, we'll show you a chart and prove something. You know, this is just a liberal conspiracy to do in God-fearing folks when it comes to the middle and lower classes, and when it comes to the higher echelons, they're not going to talk to you anyway. And then I think there's another group whose greed is just unparalleled, and then there's another group who are into power. I mean, look at this chap from Exxon who used to talk in stern terms about Russia, changed all that when they made multi-billion-dollar deals with ExxonMobil. That he would be the kind of template for that sort of person. When you move in those circles long enough, at least with some of the wealthier people I've known, you live in a bubble of unreality, which really cannot make any connection with quote-unquote ordinary people's problems. And so they would see a lot of these things in theoretical terms, but, you know, they don't have an active correspondence with some guy in jail who they met, as I did last year on a Christmas tour of jails in the South, where I went in with a gospel singing group and helped, minister to some of these people. Not that I do that for a living, but just as something I did. They don't have ordinary contact with someone that they met at a church basement festival where they were doing dishes at 1 o'clock in the morning after the fundraising event. You know, to them, a fundraising event is a black tie, white tie event at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They don't move in circles where they rub up against anybody that literally will lose their home if they have ovarian cancer because they've got a bad insurance policy or can't make a car payment and their daughter had to leave school because she can't pay for the tuition, or now she's out, but she's taking a second nursing degree to try to pay off the loan on her first college degree. So they do not rub shoulders with these guys. They are living in a bubble. And, of course, when that bubble bursts, it's too late for the rest of us. And so I just think that the worst people to put in charge of anything most of the time are the kind of billionaire class, not because billionaires are inherently evil, but they by the very nature of the stratus they live in, they are unconnected on a simple wisdom, common sense basis to where most people are from. Once in a while in history, you get someone like Andrew Carnegie, who's an exception and sees idealism as part and parcel of what he does. Not that he was a terribly nice man to some of his workers all the time with his union busting, but you know, he did die having not only given it all away, but having built all these libraries across the world, over 1,300 of them all told, amazingly beautiful architectural structures, sharing his wealth in a way that he hoped would educate, and then starting a peace foundation in a desperate attempt to avert the First World War, started by exactly the white oligarchical class of people cut off from reality that sent millions to their death in Europe. These were the people who did it. It was the white industrialist class of Britain, France, and Germany, and a paranoid Germany at that point, jealous of the power of other countries, run by someone exactly like Donald Trump, by the way. You know, we've been here, done that. You don't want these people in charge of anything. They created the First World War, and they're going to create whatever comes out of this, and it's not going to be good.
Well, but how do you explain, Frank Schaefer, why a former Catholic like Mike Pence became an evangelical Christian and is motivated, as you've said, as much by Ayn Rand and her writing as anything that Jesus Christ stood for? And after all, Jesus Christ was a countercultural rebel. He rebelled against the establishment. He didn't hate homosexuals. He didn't love assault rifles. He didn't shake down poor people for money on television. He actually administered to the poor all the time and made it pretty clear that that was his priority.
Yeah.
Ayn Rand has contempt for the poor. And also, you know, Paul Ryan, who's a conservative Catholic, he's a big follower of Ayn Rand. And, and you've got Newt Gingrich, another who converted to conservative Catholicism. And after all, it was a cabal of right-wing Catholics and Opus Dei people inside the FBI who helped defeat Hillary Clinton at the last minute with the letter from Comey. So what is the connection in your mind between conservative Christians and Ayn Rand?
Well, let's back up, take one step back. What's their connection between any of the right-wing program and Christianity? And I think it's this. Coming out of the 60s into the 70s with Roe v. Wade and the decision on abortion, a huge chunk of the evangelical and Catholic world saw themselves as permanently alienated from the American ruling class that treated what they regarded as the murder of the unborn as a settled matter not to be discussed any longer. And the ruling class from the left, and I'm not talking politically, but the chattering class, the editorial board of the New York Times, the major networks, the Wall Street Journal at that time, the Washington Post, they might have had different views on politics, and the Wall Street Journal page might have been one way and the Times the other. But essentially, they ignored religion. So the New York Times has a style section. It has a food section. It has an art section. It has a book section. It has dedicated sections to science and all sorts of things. They've never had a religion section. The last major news magazine that had one was Newsweek. And I remember the last religion editor there. You would think that the 18th and 19th century move towards secularism had been achieved and that there was nobody to rise up in the name of Islam or Christianity or anything else that has religious background. You would think theology is a moot point. I would just submit to you and say that had Hillary Clinton been reading for the last 40 years, the religion section of the New York Times that never exist, that would have explained to her the theology of the Reconstructionist movement that Mike Pence is part of, that believes you should go to the Old Testament law and enforce it on people. Had she understood the alienation and the fury in the heartland over the abortion issue that has never been settled in the minds of millions of people who have felt ignored and insulted by that direction. Had she understood the level of absolute ignorance that evangelical curriculums in teaching anti-science had sunk to in the homeschool movement and the hatred of our country, people from the left who had brains and compassion and heart would have been addressing these things. I lay a lot of the blame for where we are today on the blinkered mentality of the left's elites, not the right-wing elites only, but the left. They opened the door to the Mike Pences and these people who have made holy war on the country by basically doing this, and that is by alienating the rank and file simply by not addressing their concerns. I'm not saying they would have to agree with them all, but always coming from a position of ignorance and not really knowing what has made these movements tick. They think only in political and technocratic terms. It's all about GDP. They're familiar with who shows up at the Davos Economic Forum. They don't have a clue who shows up at the religious leadership conferences unless a politician goes there and it makes a brief headline with Rachel Maddow or someone. And that's it. So essentially, I have bad news for people who come from the secular environment and think that somehow the Enlightenment has won out. We are in an age of religion. You know, ISIS is beheading people. Mike Pence is going to prosecute a far-right, evangelical, theologically driven war on gay people. This is where we're really at. And congratulations to the mainstream media for ignoring what makes a third or more of this country tick, the white evangelical vote that definitely put Trump in power. You know, you can talk about the Russians until the cows come home. You're talking about margins there, or the FBI leaking that letter. Yes, these things were all important and they were awful. But, you know, if the evangelical vote, say, had been split, or even 10 or 15% less of them showed up to vote, Hillary would be president. And misunderstanding the importance of presuppositional thinking and philosophy and where religion actually stands on some of these things has hurt not just the Democratic Party, but the liberal movement in this country, which, by the way, I'm part of and all for and fight for. But ignorance on the left has hurt the chances of the Democratic Party. Religion matters. Philosophical presuppositions matter. Understanding Mike Pence now is it's late in the game to try to figure out what makes this guy tick. You know, the Reconstructionist movements he's part of that was begun with people like Rusev Rashtuni that I knew personally back in the late 60s and 70s in reaction to what they regarded as the secularization of the country and the sexual revolution of the 60s and the abortion rulings and all the rest of it. And then before that, the Bible-based war against integration by Bible-thumping Southern segregationists. You know, understanding how they use their Bibles, understanding their prejudices rooted into their fondest beliefs and religious hopes for an afterlife and all the rest of this, this is something we've ignored, and we're paying a price. So essentially, when you look at the way, you know, where we have wound up, if you don't understand the theology of the Reconstructionists, you don't have a clue what Mike Pence is going to do. You see, he looks at this as a kind of through a split lens. On one side, he's a loyal evangelical Christian who believes in Jesus the peacemaker. When it comes to policy, he is a Reconstructionist believing that you have to use everything, including violence and state coercion, to liquidate opposition to what he believes is God's kingdom on earth. That has to be imposed if it isn't willingly adopted. Without understanding that theology, you can't understand where he's coming from. And the things these people do don't make sense, and we underestimate them time and again. And we've just done it before. I mean, how many times have I heard over the last 20 years people reacting to something like, say, my memoir, Crazy for God, where I talk about why I came out of the evangelical movement and left it, who my parents were, and in Crazy for God talk all about the beginning of the religious right and so forth. People saying, well, that's all in the past now, isn't it? I mean, we've moved on, and we have, you know, gay marriage, and we've got this, and we've got that, and surely we've turned a corner. And I keep saying we have not turned a corner because the theology and the ugly, hate-filled politics it produces is not being addressed by people on the other side. It's just being glossed over or dismissed as just, well, they're all stupid people because they believe these things. And underestimated and not addressed. And here we are. We've got Donald Trump. And we've got him because of that voter bloc more than any other single factor. The evangelical Christian put him in power, not Vladimir Putin. All of that is merely details. Those are footnotes. That's the That's the story around the edge. The big story is, why did white Christian America just hire a sociopath, egomaniac, moron as our next president? That is the issue here, and that's the one that has to be addressed squarely. You cannot duck this stuff.
Sure.
Religion has to be addressed.
Well, Frank, I thank you so much for joining us here today on Christmas Day.
Hey, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Frank Schaefer, who is a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. He, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. And his novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, Sex, Mum, and God. And his latest book is And God Said Billy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether Vice President Mike Pence is actually running the Trump administration and whether he has theocratic or dominionist tendencies. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And on this Christmas Day, I'm speaking with Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. He's worked as an investigative editor at Planned Parenthood Federation of America, as communications director at the Institute for Democracy Studies, and co-founded the important blog group about the Christian right, Talk to Action. His books include Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. And he has an article in The Public Eye, Dominionism Rising, A Theocratic Movement Hiding in Plain Sight. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frederick Clarkson.
Hi, thanks for having me back, and Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays.
Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays to you, Frederick, and my understanding is that President-elect Donald Trump is essentially holed up in Trump Tower, watching cable news all day, getting upset with when they don't say nice things about him and making crazy tweets in the middle of the night. His only fun comes from these rallies where he gets the adoration of the crowd, which feeds him. But by and large, we sort of have an absentee landlord in charge of America. And the real work is being done by Mike Pence. And essentially what we have under Mike Pence is the Koch brothers cabinet, their dream come true. So if Mike Pence is going to be the effective president, and if indeed Trump is impeached because of the Russian-Putin money connection, which eventually I think it will come out, then in fact what my suggestion is that perhaps the Republicans don't even need him. I mean, he's delivered them all the prize. So what happened there? Do you think the Pence and the religious right and the Republican Party essentially made a deal with Trump and they could deal him out?
Well, it certainly is possible they could deal him out for a number of reasons, the Russians being among them, the emoluments clause being another. He's so profoundly conflicted of interest, it's one of the clearest provisions in the Constitution. You just can't benefit, you know, from as president or an executive from foreign policy. And it seems like Trump foreign policy would be all about benefiting his business interests. So he may not make it very far at all. Or if he does, it will be a real affront to constitutional governance.
But in am I being too cynical in suggesting that the man who wrote The Art of the Deal, effectively what happened was the Republican establishment didn't want him, but then he won by unorthodox methods and by the media giving him $5 billion worth of free advertising. And once he got the nomination, they sort of figured out, well, you know, maybe this we can make a deal with this guy.
Yeah, I mean, politics and business are all about deals, aren't they? The idea that there wouldn't be deals involved would be a foolish point of view. I think the challenge for us all is to figure out what kind of deals, in fact, have been made and which ones they're going to keep. I think that the Christian right made themselves a very, very good deal in backing Donald Trump, even though he's not their guy, even though he's the godless philanderer guy, the playboy who says awful things and doesn't seem to stand for any kind of Christian values, conservative or anybody else's. But he is the deal maker, and you can make a deal with him. And in fact, they delivered their vote, and he's delivering prominent positions in government and in policy making that stand at odds to where he's been in his life and his public career. I think we're seeing that play out on a historic scale.
Well, he certainly got somebody that the Christian right have to be happy with as the head of the Department of Education, a homeschooler Christian fundamentalist, right, who wants to basically defund public education, create vouchers for Christian schools. And as I say, Betsy DeVos is a huge champion of homeschooling and Christian education.
Well, that's right. She's always seen her work in education as advancing God's kingdom. So to the idea of taking apart the public schools so that the pieces can be reorganized to advance her particular kind of Christianity and aligned versions, but at least to take out the competition. The idea of secular publication means you have an opposition to advancing your agenda, and that's the first task. And privatization and vouchers and charters is how you do it.
And again, I'm speaking with Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. He's worked as an investigative editor at Planned Parenthood Federation of America, as communications director at the Institute for Democracy Studies, and co-founded the important group blog about the Christian right, Talk to Action. And his books include Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. And he has an article at In the Public Eye, Dominionism Rising, a Theocratic Movement Hiding in Plain Sight. So let's talk about the Dominionists. We've talked about Christian fundamentalists in terms of Betsy DeVos, Trump's nominee for Secretary of Education. Are there any other payouts to the Christian right before we get into the conversation about who's a Dominionist in this administration, the new administration?
Oh, well, sure. You certainly begin with Mike Pence himself, who's really been a Christian right figure in his own right long before he assumed the candidacy of vice president. And he soon appointed as head of the transition team as well, which is unusual for a vice president. So the transition team is stocked with Christian right figures. And they're policy people. Perhaps the most prominent of them is the head of the domestic issues side, Ken Blackwell, who's an African-American politician from Ohio who is a senior fellow at the Family Research Council, the leading lobby for Christian right interests in Washington, D.C. So that alone is an indicator of the kinds of people that Pence and Trump want to stock the administration with, and the kind of policies they want to advance. We've certainly seen that in many ways, but also in the cabinet, Ben Carson, the neurosurgeon who ran for president and didn't make it, who's nominee for housing and urban development, and arguably Jeff Sessions, the candidate for attorney general, U.S. senator, who's been very publicly opposed to advances in gay rights, and particularly marriage equality. and isn't shy about invoking his religious views to justify those kinds of positions. So those are the biggies, but there are many more.
Well, you couldn't get a bigger biggie than Mike Pence, because arguably he is the president. So, yes. But is he a Dominionist?
Well, it's a fair question. He's famous for having said that, in terms of his political identity, that I'm a Christian first, a conservative second, and a Republican third, in that order. So having identified himself that way, it's like, well, okay, how then does his Christianity inform his politics and his approach to governance and policy? And I think he illustrated that as governor of Indiana with some of the fiercest anti-abortion legislation advocated in the United States, being the supporter and ultimately signing the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, a state-level piece of legislation that was intended to justify discrimination against gay people generally and married couples in particular, such that the businesses wouldn't have to see themselves as complicit in gay marriage. So the legislature had to reconvene in the wake of the national protest to state specifically that the legislation was not intended to do that. And the Christian right that had supported their legislation and backed Mike Pence and was there at the at the signing were outraged and felt betrayed by Mike Pence when he had to sign the amendment passed by the legislature in order to defend the state's business interests. So he's a complicated guy as far as that goes. He is a politician. He's not a theologian. But nevertheless, he is the guy who whose constituency has been the Christian right and who was the payoff by Donald Trump to the Christian right in exchange for their support. And so far, the way he's leading the transition team makes clear that he's heading things in that direction, the key piece being the idea of using religious freedom to gain exemptions from existing civil rights and labor laws to advance conservative Christian and business interests in a way and a scale that we've never seen in American history.
Well, of course, what happened in Indiana with Pence having to back away from the bill that he championed, which essentially under the guise of Christian freedom, for the want of a better description, encouraged intolerance, particularly against LGBT rights. And then when all of the big sports teams and the big corporations decided to start boycotting Indiana, he had to change. So there you have it in a nutshell.
And other Christian denominations, I might add, too. The mainline denomination, Protestant denomination, Disciples of Christ, is headquartered in Indianapolis, and they were prepared to move their national convention out of state, and we're talking about moving their national headquarters out of state over the issue. So, yeah, there's been principled Christian opposition to Mike Pence's form of dominionism, even in his home state.
Well, then let's talk a little bit about, since we have a government of, for, and by the Koch brothers in alliance with the Christian right, and they'll all get what they want. They may get an overturning of Roe v. Wade, they get the killing of the Affordable Care Act, and they may even get overturned Obergefell at the Supreme Court, the important recent gay rights ruling. And again, I'm speaking with Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. He's worked as an investigative editor at Planned Parenthood Federation of America, as communications director at the Institute for Democracy Studies, and co-founded the important group blog about the Christian right, Talk to Action. And his books include Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. And he has an article at In the Public Eye, Dominionism Rising, a Theocratic Movement Hiding in Plain Sight. So let's talk a little bit about, now that we have the religious right in ascendancy in this country, let's talk a bit about the religious left, because all of the great movements in social history, like ending slavery, getting the women's vote, ending child labor, the civil rights movement, they all had a deep religious component, particularly when you go back to ending slavery, it became a moral issue, an issue of conscience. And you had a powerful religious left that led those movements. We don't have an opposition left in this country. The Democratic Party is in disarray. The DNC is full of just dead-enders. And it's pathetic. You know, you look at the lexicon of all of these Democrats who've led the country into presidential defeats. You know, the Susan Essridges, the Robbie Mooks of the world. God knows why where they find these people, but they're going to have to find some other people. At the moment, we're without an opposition. So on a social level, since we're dead politically, can we revive the religious left?
Well, the short answer is yes. There have been stirrings of a prophetic ministry coming out of many elements of the religious community for many years, but they've been under sustained assault by the right as well, and are internally divided. But that said, where there are movements where people can join forces across their religious differences and their denominational divides, there's room for opportunity. The best, most organized example is Reverend William Barber and his Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina that has successfully fused together lots of different kinds of community interests. He's the head of the NAACP in the state and brings a fierce, old-style African-American Southern preaching style to his political organizing, but he's gone out of his way to make sure that people who are not believers are welcome, and that it has an inclusive vision that cuts across issues of reproductive rights and approaches to LGBTQ equality, because he's able to get across the idea that we're all in this together against the Koch brothers type people and the Christian right type leaders who are about oppressing and dividing people. He has the most powerful prophetic voice in the country right now, and a 10-year record of pulling unusual coalitions together.
But you accept the premise, surely, Frederick, that the great movements of history have been led by people of conscience, people of faith, and essentially, in a loose sense, the religious left.
Well, absolutely. And in addition to the issues you talked about, you know, the child labor was abolished in the United States, and in a coalition of economically progressive Catholics, some of the same people who helped to create the New Deal, as well as the socially conscience-oriented Protestants who really led the way. With the civil rights movement you mentioned, but also the movements for women's equality. And people often forget that the role of the churches and religious leaders in ending the Vietnam War. There's a famous picture of Martin Luther King and William Sloan Coffin and Rabbi Abraham Heschel, you know, marching together, not in opposition to the Vietnam War. And Martin Luther King died, you know, when he was helping to lead a garbage workers' strike in Tennessee. So, yes, there's a profound moral consciousness that can be brought to the occasion, and a passion articulation and a style of leadership that works at moments like this.
Well, in the last couple of minutes on this Christmas Day, Frederick Clarkson, what parting words do you have on this religious holiday, although it's been heavily commercialized, for our audience in terms of, you know, we've talked pretty much, made it pretty clear that the conditions at the moment indicate a rightward drift, the greatest issue facing the planet for its very survival. Global warming is not going to be dealt with, and the causes of global warming will be increased with Rex Tillerson and Vladimir Putin pumping every bit of oil they can get their hands on. So what's your final parting thoughts?
Well, first is don't despair. We are all in this together, and that there are many more of us than there are of them. And the goal of the plutocrats and the theocrats is to pit people against one another, because there aren't enough of them. But if we're all fighting among each other, we won't be able to to organize and come up with a common plan to return our democracy to some kind of sanity. This is an achievable thing. even, and if we turn off the cable television for a while and begin to talk with one another, a lot of things are possible.
And do you see, for example, I brought up global warming, which will not be dealt with by these deniers, and we reached a point, a crucial point, where even a tipping point. Could that be a movement that could unite all of these various factions on the left that are only interested in their own particular piece of the pie?
Well, I think so. Certainly, I think the Battle of Standing Rock in South Dakota demonstrated what was possible. They stopped a major oil pipeline. Native Americans in the coalition with many, many others took a stand, and people helped them. And the issue was the future of the fossil fuel industry in the United States and which way we were going to go. It was a battle. It's part of a larger war, but I think it's indicative of what's possible.
Right, but first thing that Donald Trump will do when he gets in office is reverse everything that Obama did in that regard. So I would say the battle is not over. It's just beginning.
Well, like I say, it's a battle as a part of a larger war, unfortunate metaphor. But no war is defined necessarily by any one battle, win or lose. And we have to keep a persistence of vision and commitment to make sure that we have better outcomes. Again, Donald Trump has the bully pulpit. He may be a bully, but that doesn't necessarily mean he has the hearts and minds of all the people. There's still lots of possibility as we turn off our televisions and begin to talk one another and to figure out what needs to be done.
Well, I thank you very much for your Christmas message, and I'm sure a lot of people are sitting around the table with their friends and family, and I hope that they do have the TV turned off, but obviously not the radio.
Indeed.
Well, I thank you for joining us on this Christmas Day, Frederick Clarkson.
Well, thank you, Ian. Anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Frederick Clarkson, who's a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and an analyst of the religious right for over 30 years. He's worked as an investigative editor at Planned Parenthood Federation of America, as communications director at the Institute for Democracy Studies, and co-founded the important group blog about the Christian right, Talk to Action. His books include Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. And he has an article at In the Public Eye, Dominionism Rising, a Theocratic Movement Hiding in Plain Sight. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon, and I'd like to wish everybody a happy Christmas and happy holidays, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.